Welcome to the Institute for Strategic Policy Solutions. My name is Kimberly Jackson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Institute. For those of you all who don't know, the Institute is a think tank embedded in St. Petersburg College, created by Congressman Young, where we have thoughtful, reflective conversations on social, political, and economic issues that are nonpartisan. We serve St. Petersburg College, and we are trying to serve our mission of getting to the Florida college system to educate students and to have meaningful and reflective conversations. And today, I'm so honored to have this program that is sponsored in part by the Urban League as our partners, and our professor of social behavioral sciences, Professor Loriero, who's probably upset that I just said that right now, but I'm very grateful for his partnership. I also like to introduce, just for the record, just to acknowledge one of our school board members from District 7, Caprice Edmond, who took the time out of her day to come out to be with us today, and I'm very grateful for her presence as well. This program is going to be one of our typical formats where it's moderated by my colleague, Dr. Moore, that I will introduce shortly, and then also we will take questions and answers to the extent we are able. I'm so excited to talk to two sons of St. Petersburg and learn a little bit about why they bent the arc of our city. And I'm very grateful again to have the opportunity to speak with someone who led so much change for our city. Before we begin with our moderator, I'd like to introduce Frank Peterman. Frank Peterman was a former member of the St. Petersburg City Council, a state representative, and the secretary of the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice. He is currently the pastor of the Rock of Jesus Missionary Baptist Church. Leon, thank you. Leon Jackson is a member of the Courageous 12. An offer of the Urban Buffalo Soldiers, the story of St. Petersburg's Courageous 12. And we'll give more context to that, but this is the last remaining gentleman of the men who integrated the St. Petersburg Police Force and deserves our great honor and respect for what he did to enhance our community. And last but not certainly not least is Dr. Joy Moore Cruz. She is an administrator, a mathematician, an educator, an engineer, and a scholar. She has a BSE in electrical engineering from Princeton University, a MS in mathematical sciences, and a PhD in mathematics and education from the University of Cincinnati. She is currently serves as our acting associate dean of academic services, as well as the academic chair of mathematics department on the Clearwater campus at St. Petersburg College. And I can say this because I know her well, she mentors a ton of us at the college. So with that, we'll get started and take it away.
Okay, so I guess my microphone is on. I think I hear myself. Our first question is directed toward Officer Jackson, Officer Leon Jackson. The question is, what was it like to be a police officer when you started your career versus after the Courageous 12 filed a lawsuit? And for those that may not understand what the lawsuit was regarding, when the African Americans were allowed on the police force, they were not allowed to police the white communities. So they were restricted to black neighborhoods. They were only allowed to arrest African American citizens. They could not arrest white citizens. And so they were restrained and constricted in doing their jobs. If you see a criminal, someone's committing an act of crime, and they happen to be white, they were not allowed to do it. They did not have the authority to do that. So they filed a lawsuit of discrimination, asking for the full rights and authority that every police officer should have on any police department. The filing was made in May of 1965. It was rejected and turned down in 1966. They made an appeal. It was rejected by the federal court in 1966. So in 1968, they made an appeal, and the case went in their favor. It took another year before Officer Leon Jackson became the first African-American police officer to be assigned to an all-white neighborhood in St. Petersburg, in that community. So the question to him is, what was it like to be a police officer when you first started your career versus after the Courageous 12 filed a lawsuit? It was 12 out of the 15 African-American police officers that filed this lawsuit.
Okay, thank you. My name is Leon Jackson, of course. I'm one of the Courageous 12. I was hired on the St. Petersburg Police Department on October 3rd, 1963. When I first came, I graduated from the police academy. And I went to work at the St. Petersburg Police Department, and I noticed the police department was not integrated. African-American police officers were always assigned to work in the African-American neighborhood only. We could only investigate complaints from African-American citizens. We could only arrest African-American citizens. We could not work in a white neighborhood. We could not investigate complaints from white citizens. We could not even arrest whites during that time. White police officers had unlimited authority. They can work all over the city. They can investigate complaints from all citizens. They could arrest everybody. The procedure was that if there were a reason why we would have to arrest a white person, we would have to call in and have a white police officer come to the scene and transport the prisoner to jail. And that's one of the leading things about why we filed a lawsuit. What happened is this. We met with the chief of police twice, and he didn't do anything about our complaint. So we request a third meeting, and at that point, the chief refused to meet with us anymore. So we knew right then that the chief was not going to address our complaints. So we voted to file a lawsuit against the St. Petersburg Police Department. And we hired Attorney James Sanderlin and Reverend Peterman's father, Attorney Frank Peterman Sr., to represent us. We went to federal court in Tampa, and Judge Joseph Lieb ruled against us and ruled in favor of the police department. But we didn't give up. We had contacted the NAACP, and the NAACP filed the appeal for us at no cost. And on August 1st, 1968, the appeals court ruled in our favor. That lawsuit was directly in the middle of the civil rights era. Note, I stated that it happened in 1965. 1965 was the same year the Selma to Montgomery March took place. 1965 was the same year that President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. Remember when I said that the appeals court ruled in our favor on August 1st, 1968. 1968 was the same year that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. So it happened directly in the middle of the civil rights era. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Officer Jackson. So then the next question was, it's about the sanitation strike, in particular the sanitation strike of 1965. How did that impact St. Pete? And Pastor Peterman, if you'd like to take that question, there actually had been two strikes prior in the previous 2 years, but in 1965 there was another sanitation strike, sir.
Thank you, Frank Peterman. I heard that it turned out really well. That my father and the other attorneys fought on the behalf of the striking garbage workers. And they have pictures of it, and as a matter of fact, in my office, a very, very proud moment. It was pretty difficult because they were trying to get better wages and better working conditions. And back then, you know, I don't know if the wonderful people here might not remember, as some of us would, where you went and got your trash cans were you put on their backs, so it's not there wasn't a device to take the trash can and dump it into the you know the container. These men were very strong men. They had to grab the trash can and put it on their backs, carry it to the truck and dump it in. So you can imagine how labor intensive that was and how. A lot of them probably had back issues, if not other things. And so, you know, the sanitation piece, the fact that they were coming in contact with dangerous chemicals and other things. And so they went on a strike, and my father and other attorneys represented them. Wonderful picture of Father Creole Cafe. I was the owner. Showed it to me the other day. I hadn't seen it, and hoping to take it to my father. My father's 85 now, and I want to shoot him a picture of when he was talking to the city manager at that time, white city manager in the 60s. But it went well. I think there was some relief of some kind for them. I don't know if they got all that they wanted, but I think the working conditions changed. And the wages, I believe, changed and were better. And I just like to say this other thing. St. Pete has a wonderful history. The African Americans in St. Pete, we have a wonderful history of confrontation. Now, it's not always the kind of confrontation some would like, but we don't really back down much in St. Pete. We just don't. African Americans seem to confront when they're put upon. By larger, let's say, oppressive systems. And so he's a wonderful example of that. And the other Courageous 12, I knew those guys. My father, like I said, was one of the lead attorneys. And one of the ones I was really close to was one of the leaders of the group was Freddie Crawford, a great leader in that group. And it was a tireless work and very confrontational. And so it worked out well, but it shows you the fight, the essence of the fight in St. Pete. You know, that's who we are, and we just won't be put upon. Thank you very much.
It was an organized effort, and my research reveals that at the end of this 1965 strike, sanitation strike, the African-American workers were unable to get the wage for a 40-hour work week that they previously had been getting for a 48-hour work week. So the wages did increase. They were able to get what it was that they needed. Sanitation strikes had been used throughout the country, that when Martin Luther King in 1968 was assassinated, he was in Memphis supporting the sanitation workers there that were striking for their manhood and their dignity, that they deserved an equal wage for the work that they were doing. And so this sanitation strike impacted St. Pete in the same way, and as Pastor Peterman has said, is representative of how St. Pete citizens decided that they would stand up for their dignity and for their legal rights, and the spirit of the city was revealed through that sanitation strike. So then this third question, Peggy Peterman, who happens to be the mother of Pastor Peterman. And for those of you that don't know, this month, March, is Women's History Month. So Peggy Peterman is a great name for me right now. It holds a lot of history and significance to me, as my attire today would reveal, that though she calls me SPC royalty, I knew I was going to be in the presence of St. Petersburg royalty. And my mother was always very emphatic about me understanding that the history of African Americans in this country did not begin when the slave ships arrived here, but that we had a history in Africa of royalty before we were ever stepped foot on the shores of this country. And so Peggy Peterman, Lifetime Achievement Award, two of them, one from the National Association of Black Journalists and another from the International Women's Media Foundation, as well as being the mother of Pastor Peterman. She was a graduate of Howard University, and she was the first African-American journalist at what was then St. Petersburg Times, which is now the Tampa Bay Times. And when she came on to the newspaper, they had a page, one page, for black news. It was one page, and it was only given out into the black neighborhoods. And so she was hired to be a journalist for the black news page. And she decided this needs to be integrated. The news and the lives of my people are stories that should be told to everyone. Everyone should have access. And so her writing was very revolutionary in that she really wanted to describe the lives and the humanity of the African-American citizens in St. Petersburg. So she abolished the Negro news pages back in the 60s. And the question is, how has the media, specifically the local news in St. Petersburg, evolved over time covering the black community? And the question is the media where it should be? And either of you are welcome to answer the question if you'd like to address it.
Well, I was, I grew up as a Times guy running around Tampa, then the St. Pete Times, and my mother worked there. And so I saw it in the days of, you know, the earlier presidents and editors and everything. And she dealt with a lot of racism within the Times at the time. My father, as I remember it, had the one particular editor that he would, even as an attorney, he would come down there and straighten out a few things years ago, and she didn't have any other problems with that particular editor. I would say that it's evolved and gotten to a decent place. My mother taught me the same way your mother taught you about Black history and also the history of racism, because you can't really clearly define and articulate what is happening in the media unless you deal with that. And I think a lot of times we try to work around that, and you just can't. It is what it is. And until you speak to it, when you speak to it and open it up, then we can have better, you know, conversations about where we really should be going. So to your point, it has evolved, you know, it's better than it was. But I remember when they would have pictures, she showed me how photographers would take a picture of a Black person in a certain pose, and it gave off a negative image as opposed to a white person taking another pose. It was really nice, pristine and everything. And so I began to look very closely at those particular things, very subtle things that really were reality. It was reality. But as much as we evolved and it's gotten better, I was looking at the paper the other day. This is the way I was trained by my mother. And most of the paper is, and that's nothing against anyone. It's mostly Caucasians, our wonderful white brothers and sisters. It's not a lot of us still in the paper, and sometimes when they do report it, it's about, you know, someone going to jail or some negative reality. When in fact, if you do the numbers, the data probably would show that people in the larger majority group probably have higher data in terms of going to jail, but they're not put in a paper at the same rate. And so just by the sheer numbers, you know, we're a smaller group. So the other thing is, I looked at the Explorer page. So the Tampa Bay Times now is doing a wonderful job looking at high school sports. You know, they didn't have it for a while, right, because of COVID and the print media is beginning to dry up a little bit. And I looked at the Explorer area, and I think just about every time I look at it, I've been waiting for some Black narratives, some Black stories. Wonderful now. They got Shorecrest and people playing volleyball at, you know, Northside Christian and base softball at Calvary Christian. Those are wonderful places, and those are wonderful, wonderful students. But I'd love to see more stories about what's happening at Lakewood and Gibbs, and there got to be some things happening at, you know, Bogie, and I mean African American kids. I didn't see that, and that's another example. In the Explorers, I almost brought it here when I saw that question. This is why the Black press is still important. People ask, why do you want your own thing? Well, when you look at the Explorer page, 90% of the people who've been reported on are people are white folks. How do we get our stories out? Who's going to tell our stories? And so, although the integrated process is extremely important and it's the best thing that could have happened, there still has to be a niche somewhere for us to make sure that African Americans and other folks, other minorities and others, have an opportunity to celebrate who they are. We've come a long ways, but there's still this thing where we still don't have enough, recognition of Black lives and, you know, and Latino lives and Asian lives and others. I think that needs to be done on a broader scale.
Thank you, Pastor Peterman. I'm sure Peggy Peterman, when I announced those Lifetime Achievement Awards, I'm sure if she was with us today to tell us her greatest Lifetime Achievement Award is the legacy that she's left behind in her children. And we are honored to be in the presence of her legacy on today. I'm honored, sir. Thank you. it's important for us to realize that her necessity, why she banned the Negro News page, was because she wanted all of humanity to be represented to all people. And when we have a media that is very particular in how it chooses to represent particular groups of people, it's detrimental. If the only person I ever get to meet is this image in the media of someone, and that's all I know you to be, then it limits my ability to communicate and to relate to your humanity and for us to unify as one. So her legacy is extremely important. The next question is, what does the election of the mayor, Ken Welch, mean for the city? And Pastor, I'm going to ask you that because I know that the seat that he vacated was one that you were able to then take on. Am I correct?
Well, not quite, but... Not quite.
Officer Jackson.
I come at the. I do want to respond to it, but I want to let him.
Okay, no problem. Mayor Welch, I know his entire family, and I worked on this campaign. When we filed that lawsuit in 1965, the city of St. Petersburg was controlled by all whites. White mayor, white city manager, all white city council members, all white clerks, all white secretaries, all white city attorneys, same as the county building. The court system was controlled by all whites, white judges, white prosecutors, white public defenders, white secretaries, white bailiff. The police departments were controlled by all whites. They had only one African-American sergeant, but his authority was limited. He could only supervise we African-American police officers. He could not supervise the white police officers. And that's one of the reasons why we filed a lawsuit. We fought for him. Sadly, he did not go in with us on the lawsuit. It was 15 African Americans on the police department. 12 choose to file a lawsuit, and 3 choose not to file a lawsuit. And I say this, I'm proud to see that Mayor Welch won the election, because in 1963, when I came on the police department, I never thought I would live to see an African-American mayor. Didn't think I would ever see an African-American chief of police. And they have one African-American chief of police now, and they had one previously black chief. And I am very proud to see those two chiefs of police and Mayor Welch, and I know he would do a fantastic job because I did my research, and he is the only person that I've supported on an election. And I'm proud to see Mayor Welch in that position. Thank you. And that's one of the things that we were fighting for when we filed that lawsuit. It was not just for the police department. It was for help African Americans to get jobs in City Hall, help African Americans to get jobs in the county building, help African Americans to get jobs in the court system, help African Americans to get jobs on the police department. And that's what we were fighting for. And I am the first African-American police officer assigned to work in an all-white neighborhood. It was from 38th Avenue to 67th Avenue, east of 4th Street, which includes Snell Isle Shore Acres. I had never been to Snell Isle Shore Acres. I didn't know how to get to Snell Isle Shore Acres. I had to ask the white police officer how to get to Snell Isle Shore Acres. But what happened, I had broke that barrier. Thank you very much.
It's a good segue. You know, being on St. Pete City Council and serving there for a number of years has a lot to do with what they did. And it was a proud moment the time at that time. I think I was the youngest African-American male the first and youngest African-American male that to serve on the city council at that time. That's many years ago. But I wanted to say I'm very proud of Ken. Ken Welch is a little bit of trivia. He tells us when we're in the same room. Mayor Welch was my left tackle at Lakewood High School. I was a quarterback at Lakewood High School. So that's our thing. You know, I protect your back shot. I was behind you. Make sure no one hit you from the other side. You know, so anyway, Ken Welch is, we go way back, the same neighborhood and everything. So our families go way back too. He's also a fraternity brother, proud to say he's a fraternity brother of mine. But Ken's election is so very important because so many people fought for the right for African Americans to be in office. I'm standing on the shoulders of people like this guy, Leon, and also the first African American council member was an African American female, Seabed Wimbish. Then I think Welch came after that, and then maybe Charles Shorter, then I came after that time. So, but the first person to serve was an African American, very brilliant African American attorney, Seabed Wimbish. I just want to pay homage to her. She went on to head up, I think, a deputy in some department at the state level under the great, Governor Reuben Askew many, many years ago. So I came on the scene as a little young Turk many years after that and began to fight for issues. So Welch's election is extremely important. When you think about the issues that have happened with African Americans in this city, the riots that have taken place because of some of the shootings that took place that shouldn't have happened, African American males, the affordable housing issues that we really got to do something about, he would have an understanding of that and have a sensitivity to that. So I'm very proud, having served in office as a city council member, and also having served at least in the state legislature, served there 7.5 years. It's fun to see this type of thing. And then serving as secretary for a major department, I know how important it is to be over resources to help level the playing field. And that was the beauty of my time in that office, with 5,000 employees, facilities all over the state of Florida, almost a $700 million budget. What happens when you begin to be in those particular seats, you begin to look at the total picture and you're able to affect the total group, blacks, whites, Hispanics, Latinos, Asians, Jewish folks, whoever, Indians, all of us, we're one family, and so when you get to do that, you get a chance to have authority to make sure resources are going out on as much as you can on an equal basis that the system is put in place to do that. So his being there is important because we have a guy that can see the city comprehensively and make sure resources are hopefully, for the most part, that they're distributed as equally as possible based on policies and things, because a lot of policies, set the parameters for what you can do for certain populations. So it's very important that he's there, and I'm glad that he is. I'm really glad that he is.
Could I say something, please? Yes. I've written a book about the Courageous Twin. It's a fascinating book. Believe me, it is. It's a very, very good book. It took about a year to do it because I did a lot of research on it. It's only $10. And every household in St. Petersburg should have a copy of this book. Because what we did, we opened the doors for so many people. And remember, when we filed that lawsuit, we could have been fined. We took a big chance. Those people could have fired us. And then some of them was begging for us to get fired. But my theory is that why they didn't fire us, they would not have any African American uniform officers on the street. But we took a major chance. And I tell you, young people, when you see something wrong, racism, stand up and think about the courageous 12. Because we stood our ground and we did not back down.
Thank you, Officer Jackson. And so you've referred to some of the people in this next question about the intersectionality of race, politics, and police in the city, those three, the intersection of those three, race, politics, and police in the city, including figures such as Tyron Lewis, for those of you that may not know, was an 18-year-old African-American male who was killed by a police officer at a traffic stop. A white police officer in St. Petersburg. Goliath Davis, as they referred to, was a chief of police in St. Petersburg. I believe the years that he served for police, the chief of police was 1997. And then Anthony Holloway, who is our current chief of police in St. Petersburg, he became the chief of police in 2014, 7 years later, is still serving in that position. So do you have any other thoughts on the intersections of race, politics, and police in the city of St. Petersburg?
Well, I have a consulting company and I just sort of work with another group to deal with a focus group meeting. And we brought folks together in the community just over about a month's period of time. Chief Holloway and this particular group worked in conjunction with Bethune-Cookman University. And this particular thought leader came in and did train the police, same police department. Then he went to the community, and I was a part of pulling the community together in some of the Urban League and some other areas. But anyway. We were having this conversation. They were doing a report as we speak. A report is being tabulated or created to be brought back to St. Pete and put together an action team based on the information we got from the police, from the community, from folks who have been incarcerated, and to see if we can have an action team to really deal with issues in that community regarding those things. Now, the intersection, that's a really good piece, intersection, politics, police, and race. That's pretty powerful. Take 2 days to go over that, but it's very important to understand that we got to have people who are, who've been exposed to, I believe, to various communities, and if they haven't been, they need to be if they're police officers, to have a sensitivity, to various communities that you might have grown up in a certain part of North St. Pete. But you're working in South St. Pete as a new police officer. The cultural differences are going to be really, really vast. And so how does one, work through that? And so it's important to make sure that there's a sensitivity. We talked a lot about it during those sessions, sensitivity training for police officers. Really on both sides, too. But definitely, I believe, when white officers go into African-American communities, there's cultural differences. And I think a lot of times people, we like to say things like, well, there's no color, I don't see. Well, yeah, all of us are different colors here. It's okay. Yeah, they're different cultures, and they're different. We'll call a melting pot, aren't we, as a country? That's because they're different cultures. They're wonderful, different groups came from different countries, and we're together, and it's okay. We need to understand each other's our cultures, at least have an appreciation for them. You don't have to accept everything in it, but have at least an appreciation for it and know how to engage it. And so I think that's extremely important. You got to have political folks who are ready to back that type of behavior. Okay? And then the race piece, and that's what I'm getting, the race piece, just understand who people are. Try to understand who they are and see if we can all sort of work together. But you can't ignore, I believe, culture and race. You just can't do it. And when we do that, when we begin to do that, then I think the biases and other issues begin to creep out because you're not dealing with it. You're not dealing with it, And so the more we can deal with culture, race, and be honest about it all, and have thought leaders in the political offices that understand this and have a sensitivity to it, I think it'll make us better. And then the police, as he's often said, the police departments, you know, become, you know, he said it in his own way, he's sensitive to issues of race. Because, it's, you know, if a guy, I was in those meetings, this guy has a gun. He can decide a life or a person to have life or not have life in a moment's notice. And so it's important that we have really deep conversations about cultural intersections, you know, and political folks who are conscious enough and progressive enough to understand, hey, let's talk about this, let's work this through before we have something on our hands that could be a tinderbox and we have another race, you know, issue happening with riots and things. So have thought leaders like that, progressive people, I think is very important. I'd like to also say that, you know, Councilwoman, the school board member, Caprice Edmonds, is a wonderful example of folks coming before her. She's standing on the shoulders of Mary Brown and Pinellas County Commissioner Renee Flowers and others. So, thank God that the fight that they had and others, civil rights fight, Sandling and all those guys, made it possible for her to do what she's doing also, which is awesome.
Well, Harvey, could I make a footnote for what?
Yes, sir, please, Officer Jackson.
I think every police officer, when he or she graduates from the police academy, should be assigned to the African-American neighborhood during their probationary period to learn the culture of the African-American. Because I remember when I was working on the police department, a lot of white police officers worked there 20 years and never worked in the African-American neighborhood. And I would hear them say, I would not work down there. I'm not going to work down there. But my theory that every African-American, every police officer get out of that police academy should be assigned to work in the African-American neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you, Officer Jackson. As Pastor was recognizing our dignitary and our school board member, she is our dignitary today. We're so glad to have you with us. But also, the VIPs in the room are the students, the SPC college students are our VIPs today. And so we're very excited to have you with us. You can clap for yourself. It's okay. Recognize who you are. You are SPC royalty because you're here. So our VIPs, we would like to give you opportunity to ask questions at this time. Any questions that you might have, we'd love to hear from you. If you need a microphone or if you've texted already and we need to check our text communications. Is that how we're doing?
So we don't have any text messages right now, and I know sometimes students always feel like we are putting you on the spot by asking you. But we would like to offer the opportunity for you all to ask questions. This is an important time when you, oftentimes you read, and our wonderful SBC team, we educate you based on what we have to do, but oftentimes you don't have the opportunity to speak to historians where you can ask questions that are meaningful to you. So we'd like you to have that opportunity before we close out today. There is a question, and you have to forgive because we are in a virtual space. I'm going to walk through. I'm just going to repeat the question. Thank you, Kyle.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to the students' questions. And I just have to say the audience, for your confirmation, found your messages from the panel inspirational. And I'm somebody who doesn't like to overlook the obvious. And what's obvious to me is that what you described in your life experiences was systemic racism, but also you were both members of city government at one level or another. And, of course, you had to go to the courts, which the justice system was an obstacle at some point. And I'm also sitting amongst students, and the question occurs to me, what is your advice, counsel, on the idea of civil disobedience for change?
So the question is, what is their advice or opinions on civil disobedience for change?
Well, we sort of have one of the greatest examples of that with Martin Luther King Jr. He and his group did that. It's important, I think, to follow laws, to be a law-abiding citizen is extremely important, first of all. But when the laws are unjust laws, and they change in a negative way the life behavior of people, that they can't move freely within a certain realm, then the laws have to change. And thank God we have a democratic system and process that allows us to challenge laws when they're unjust. And thank God there have been many people who did that. And so I think it's important for young folks like we have here for them to understand that when laws are unjust and they're not right and they affect the American populace in a negative way, that you have a right to challenge those laws. You have a right, and it's almost your civic duty to do that, to be honest with you, because we live in an open democratic process. And so we call ourselves trying to be one nation. We want to be one nation. So if that's the case, then we have to challenge those things that will prevent us from being one nation and make sure that we speak to them and speak to them with force and with power. I love what the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass once said. He said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. I love that statement. Thank you.
We do have a question from one of our virtual participants, and we're going to have time for about 5 more minutes if you all think of any questions that you have before we close out. And this question, whoever asked it, is very important to me because it's about preservation of history. Mm-hmm. And one of the things of coming to this city that I think you eloquently said, Pastor, is that St. Petersburg has an extremely rich history, And it is a history of activism, and it is a history of highly educated persons who sought to preserve rights for those less fortunate or who are unable to speak for themselves, mixed with a very activated group of educated persons by experience, but not necessarily by degree, of how they engage the community. So this question asks, how can the Black community help preserve the history of St. Petersburg? One example, of course, is Mr. Jackson's, Officer Jackson's book. And I would encourage you all to, there are a lot of icons in the community who have actually written books about preserving the history, but I would like to ask that to both of you all as we close out, if there are any other questions about how do you think we should preserve the history of St. Petersburg? Please.
Well, I'm preserving the history right here. I wrote a book. Seriously. And this book here, this article here was about the Courageous 12 when we went to Frederick Court over 50 years, and this was in the St. Petersburg Times, and I'm preserving history. This is over 50 years the St. Petersburg Times wrote this article about us when we went to Frederick Court in Tampa. And I did an interview with a man, and he had this information, and he gave it to me. And this information should be in the library all over St. Petersburg for what we did, because we did a brave, brave thing to integrate St. Petersburg Police Department. So to answer your question, I'm preserving history right here.
Praise God. That's wonderful, and that's one of the major pieces. And I think the other way is through art and theatrical renderings, if you will, of certain times that things happen in history in St. Pete. My mother was did a Black History pageant for 24 years, and it got to be a really big thing. And she targeted, you know, Black doctors, what they did, you know. Then she did Black politicians, what they did in society, you know, what Black educators did in society. She would use each one of those segments, the great sports players and entertainers. She did that over a number of years, and that sort of helped to preserve history. And what's so neat about it, she actually was a professor here, one adjunct professor here one time, St. Pete College. What was so neat about it is that many of those students, they learned that history, and they would go to Florida State, Florida, St. Pete College, whatever, after coming out of that. And they would have tests on Black history, and they would ace the tests because they literally, you know, they were in plays every year learning the information. And so I think that's you know, the theatrical world could help with that, as well as telling a story in churches. And we have a African American museum here, going to the museum. You know, one of the things I want to tell the story of, it was great if I could here, there was a great Black French debate team at Gibbs High back in the late 60s, or mid to late 60s, taught by brilliant, legendary principal, retired principal Charlie Williams, who has a book. I think they might have a book in your archives here. I believe he tells the history of St. Pete. He had a Black French team that won the French competition countywide several times out of Gibbs. They went up against white competition, Black competition. They whooped everyone, and they beat the white team so much that they stopped having the competition. All of a sudden, the competition, they couldn't have it anymore. Wonder what happened. That I talk to him all the time. I said, man, you got to write another book. We got to do something with that. That's like The Great Debaters, the movie, you know, Wiley College. And so I'm trying to get him to say, if nothing else, let us honor them, the ones that are still alive at the church someday. You know, let's give them a big, you know, recognition, because kids in the church and in the community, adults need to hear about this history. It needs to be preserved. It's little known history. You wouldn't even would have known something like that happened. So anyway, I think using the medium of the church, the faith-based organizations, neighborhood resource groups, the recreation centers, art, theatrics, you know, and wonderful times like this, focus group times like this, so they would be great. I think it's extremely important. And then, like what he's done, the book. My mother said she was a writer for 31 years of Tampa Bay Times, used to be St. Pete Times. She said, she's always tell people, she was like the griot of the community, the historian. She would say, African-Americans don't write their histories down enough, Frank. And before she passed, she used to always say, write the history down, write it down. So when I do things, if I'm heading up a group or whatever, I've learned now to create a, I used to be president of the Gathering of Pastors, and one of the things I did, remembering what my mother said, because it had just started, I wanted to make sure from now until whenever, someone would be able to pick up this historical document and say, this is how this began. So I made sure I did that as president of that group, and I'll do it for anything else I have to when it's needed.
Yeah. I think we do have another question, but I wanted to add on to that. There's a rich history of oral tradition and oral communication, and what I think you all have the benefit of is primary resources. It's just a beautiful thing. I'm sort of a book nerd, and I would have just love to be in your generation of, instead of the complicated library system that some of my peers I'm looking over had to navigate for literally decades. You all can do it in 2 seconds. And that is the beauty of you all researching and engaging in your own critical analysis and thought process and developing and cultivating your own ideology. There is another question here, but there was a question. Yes.
Downtown, the Midtown campus, and we have art on display that I commissioned from local artists to capture the neighborhoods and in that, and also like a lot of pictures that capture the history. Mrs. Peterman's, I've read so many of her articles just from this collection. She is such an amazing person. But I think that as a recent graduate of USF, I think that teachers, like teaching history, have kind of a responsibility in teaching the history of also like the communities that they find themselves in. And I think relying on like historians like Vincent Rubin like is a great way to do that. And Dr. Williams is doing a great job by like preserving these collections within the college. And the last thing is we're getting his collection online. So all of that work will be available.
Can I just speak to this?
Yes.
Vincent Rubin was just a legendary historian in our community and quite an athlete years ago, the great Gibbs High back in the day. And he collected all the different artifacts of the great athletes that were at Gibbs, as well as other kinds of artifacts. It was so interesting. I was wanting to write a book. You know, I've written two books, but I want to write a book on what Gibbs meant to this community, how it kept it together. And these great athletes who were just legendary. I was reading about one of them in a book last night. I'm reading a book about FAMU and the guy from St. Pete who was great quarterback named Scruggs. But anyway, I'm so glad you're doing that. And Vincent Rubin, I tried to get them right before he passed because I wanted to write down the information because I just think Gibbs was such a powerful, powerful school back in the day, as we would say. There's a lot to be said for about it. And that history cannot be lost. And so I'm so glad you're doing it. Thank God for what you're doing. Thank you very much.
It was not a question, but it was a public service announcement that I think is worth making over the microphone, that this collection of history is being preserved on the Midtown campus. Am I correct in that? On St. Petersburg College Midtown campus, and you're the curator for that exhibit. So that was a public service announcement, not a question, but one which is worth presenting over the microphone. Please get to the Midtown campus. If you don't do it, who will? Someone has to know the story in order to be able to tell the story. It's important. Very exciting. Thank you for letting us know that.
Yes, we have one other question, which we may have to follow up with you all because I take these types of questions very seriously, and that is suggested reading for our viewers. So I think that, well, if you two have any last parting words about suggested readings, please share, including you, Dr. Moore, and then we will get back. There is a series, and I cannot think of the name of it right now, but it's almost like every capital in every state where it says, for example, women in history or African Americans in history. The one written for St. Petersburg is a very well written, at least for the time period at which it stops, to document the significant icons of the community. I think it's, in terms of its depth, it shows pictures and it really presents a good picture of what life was like during that time period.
Suggested reading?
My two would be, especially when it comes to understanding African Americans and Africans before they even came to America, is Stolen Legacy and Destruction of the Black Civilization, which shows a systematic destruction. That we didn't just come here, you know, not knowing anything, but we came from great civilizations where we were teaching the world geometry and trigonometry. We taught the world that. And a lot of the Western civilization educational system is built on African thinking. That's a whole nother conversation. And a lot, and it's sad that that's not being taught in our schools. But the great professors in Africa taught Socrates. This is documented in Plato and Aristotle. Yes. And so it's sad that we don't get to hear that. Maybe one day that'll change. So Stolen Legacy and Destruction of Black Civilization, I think, are very, very important.
Thank you. I wanted to take the time to thank you all before I close out. It was such an important conversation today to hear from people who lived life. And we don't always get that firsthand view of someone's thought process or what they experience. Officer Jackson, from your firsthand experience, I have an aunt that's 101 years old, and I love talking to her. It's my husband's aunt. And what she has seen in her lifetime is amazing, and that she is still present to speak about it just says so much. You learn so much from talking to our elder population. And Frank, although you are a dynamic person in your right, I can't imagine what it was like to grow in your household and live through that space. that you are right. You have an obligation to write many stories based on your reflections and having your parents lead this community. And thank you both for your time. And Dr. Moore, again, thank you for leading this conversation. We thought really reflectively. My colleague Sam, who I call my boss, for those of you all don't know, he's the project coordinator for the Institute for Strategic Policy Solutions, and he does an amazing job of connecting SPC and the community. And we thought hard, and you were the best reflection for that. And of course, to my colleagues in the corner who have already taken the time to embarrass, thank you so much for bringing your class down here, for bringing warm bodies into one of our first hybrid programs with students since COVID. And so we thank you all for your time, for your giving us your respect, and for listening for the entire time. And with that, I will tell you all, since you all are, I know most of you are on social media, if you would kindly like us at either on our Facebook page or on Instagram or go to YouTube or go to our website or just tell us what you want to hear about. It's always challenging to bridge the gap of social, political, and economic issues that are meaningful to you all, so we want to honor that. And thank you so much for your time. To learn more about us, please go to isbs.sbcollege.edu. Thank you guys so much.